Hi guys, thanks so much for choosing this panel. We've got an awesome group of panelists here, so I'm really excited about what we have in store, especially because environmental justice reporting is really near and dear to my heart and something that I think should be reported on more, and I think all of you agree if you're in this room. Just to introduce myself and the panelists a bit, my name is Jenny Chen. I'm a freelance reporter, and I report on environment, health, and science, and I've written for The New York Times, The Atlantic, Good Magazine, and other places. I'm joined by, let's go from all the way at the end, Vicky Monks, who's a multimedia freelancer, and she's worked as a writer, reporter, photographer, radio, and TV producer. And her work has appeared on NPR, BBC Radio, CBS 60 Minutes, National Geographic Television, PBS Online, and in National Wildlife Magazine, Rolling Stone, Vogue, and American Journalism Review. She now lives in Oklahoma, where she's working on a book about Indian country and reporting on environmental threats to Indian lands. And she is a member of the Chickasaw Nation and currently serves as a chair of the Oklahoma City Metro Chickasaw Community Council. And she's full of wonderful stories, so we'll hear about those soon. Next to her is Brian Bankowski, who serves as an editor of the Environmental Health News and its sister site, The Daily Climate. He was part of a reporting team that did some awesome work in Environmental Health News' 2012 series, Pollution, Poverty, People of Color, that won the Oaks Award Honorable Mention. He's also won the 2013 and 2014 awards for outstanding beat reporting from the Society of Environmental Journalists for his coverage of the Great Lakes region. And he's just done some really amazing work, so I'm really excited to hear from him. And next to him is Kendra Pierre-Lewis, who is an independent reporter, and she's covered issues relating to race and environmental issues for the Washington Post, Slate, In These Times, and more. She's also the author of Greenwashed, Why We Can't Buy Our Way to a Greener Planet. Next to her is Ed Williams, who's a reporter with the NPR affiliate in New Mexico's KUNM. He's working on a multimedia reporting project called Public Health New Mexico, where he reports on environmental health issues relating to everything from toxic dry cleaning chemicals to issues affecting Native Americans. And it's really exciting work that they're doing, and I'm really excited to learn more about that as well. So I was hoping that maybe we could start off by talking about why environmental justice stories are important to these reporters and why they think that more of these stories should be reported on.
I won't take too long, but I was this morning when I was putting together EHN, I was looking, I don't know how many of you are familiar with what's going on in Flint, Michigan right now. So when Detroit flipped their water or had bankruptcy, Flint stopped using Detroit water, tapped into the Flint River. And I bring this up because last week Flint found that the lead solder in the pipes was contaminating the water and all the children. And it's pertinent to this panel because the New York Times, the Guardian, the Detroit News are all doing really fine work over the past couple weeks. But it's too late for the hundreds of children in Flint who are already born into a city rife with poverty and all kinds of problems who now have lead in their systems at levels that's far exceeding what the state says is okay. I just think it's a very current and very good example of if there was an intrepid reporter who was asking, well, why is the state not checking corrosion in these pipes before we tap into it? I mean, these are the kind of questions that good environmental justice reporters, good reporters, period, should be asking. And in this case, it would have saved children, you know, IQ points, potentially, and lifetimes of problems. So,
sort of to piggyback on that, everybody remembers Freddie Gray in Baltimore, right? There were riots, like it was kind of a big deal. And he had a long track record of petty crimes, and he was lead poisoned. And so there was a direct, I mean, like, there's the moral... there's a moral argument as to why environmental justice matters, but there's also sort of a really pragmatic perspective where a lot of environmental health problems have strong correlations with crime and just like general well-being. So like, if you don't want to get mugged, if you like kind of want to live in a safe neighborhood, like it's really important to look out for all members of society. And so the reason I bring up that like Freddie Gray was lead poisoned, he was like he had severe cognitive difficulties. We pretty much set him up for a lifetime of not being able to function in society without a social net. We were basically priming him to be kind of like a lifelong petty criminal. And it seems very separate from issues of environmentalism, but they're pretty much one-to-one. And so if you're looking at it, like, there's a moral argument, which I'm totally proof and proud of, but, like, if you're looking at it from a purely egotistical, like, very homo capitalistic sort of man and totally self-involved, it's, like, a huge reason why it matters.
For me, these things don't really show up in the media as much as they should. In New Mexico, almost all, or I think probably all, the most egregious polluters in the state are either on Native American land or directly upstream from Native American land. So you have Isleta Pueblo just south of Albuquerque getting all the municipal and military waste from Albuquerque and Kirtland Air Force Base, hexavalent chromium and radioactive storm runoff going into San Ildefonso Pueblo. In the Navajo Nation, there's more than 500, maybe hundreds more than 500 abandoned uranium mines that just haven't been cleaned up since, you know, the 40s. And, you know, I could go on. The state's only coal-fired power plant is in the middle of the Navajo Reservation. And these are things that have real health and cultural impacts on the people that they're affecting. But like I said, for some reason, there's not much of a presence in the media, or not much as I think should be, covering these issues, maybe because they're so long-standing. But I think it's important to maintain a level of public attention on these things, if nothing else, to keep people aware of these problems that are still going on, just like they have for a very long time.
You can argue in the case of like the Navajo Reservation that it's a little bit physically more isolated, but there are plenty of cases where that's not true, that like that physical isolation isn't there, or where, like, if you look at New York City, like, you know, Gowanus was filthy for years and nobody gave a damn until rich people started moving into those communities and were like, oh, well, we don't really like it when sewage backs up into our basement, so why did this happen? Even those communities had complained for decades. And so that's kind of an important piece of it, I think.
I agree, Kendra, absolutely. It's people who are not wealthy and not powerful don't get attention in the news media. They don't get attention from the political power structure. And as journalists, I believe it's our obligation to close some of that gap and say we are going to pay attention even if the political system is not paying attention. And I'm going to talk a little bit later about one case in Oklahoma involving industrial pollution where a Native American community was subjected to horrendous contamination for years and years, that, and, you know, everyone, all of the agencies were turning a blind eye to this. But the other point is that it doesn't just, when it's a minority community, it doesn't just affect that community. It wasn't just affecting the Ponca Indians in that case. It affects a broad swath of society, and, you know, and that includes low-income people of all types.
Right. I think you make a very, very good point, Vicky. I think a lot of these marginalized communities are often the canary in the coal mine for other larger health issues. So a lot of you brought up the idea that environmental justice stories are reporting on communities that, and stories that often are underreported. So I know each of you kind of come about your stories differently, and I was wondering if each of you could talk a little bit about how you find the stories that haven't been reported and need to be reported.
I like talking about this because it, the story eventually is going to have a happy ending. I grew up in Oklahoma. I left for 25 years and then came back to work on a book about Indian country. I was interviewing some Ponca people in White Eagle near Ponca City. And one of them, Casey Camp Horanek, I don't know if all of you had the opportunity to hear her on opening night. Casey was one of the people I was talking with, and she said, and my subject was not environmental. Casey said, "You're an environmental reporter. Here is the story. You need to look at this because I can't get anybody else to pay attention." What it was, there's a plant that produces carbon black, and that is that is an ultra-fine particulate that is used in the production of tires. It's in every tire made. It makes the tires strong, and it gives them the black color. But because it's ultra-fine, it's difficult to control. It's difficult to keep it from escaping. There is technology to do this, but unless the best technology is employed, it can escape from the plant. And when it does, ultrafine particulates can be inhaled extremely deeply into the lungs, where they enter the bloodstream, they affect the cardiovascular system, they can even affect the brain. It is awful. They can, as you pointed out, it can change behavior. It's insidious stuff. So this plant was put in near Ponca land in the 1950s, and they promised that it would be state-of-the-art containment. It never was. If you know anything about the way Indian land was divided up, people got allotments. And they were limited to their parcel of 160 acres, and they had to live there. They didn't have any other land. The tribes had to get, the tribes lost all the rest of their land. So a lot of people had allotments right around this carbon black plant. And as, early as the mid-50s, they were waking up blowing black stuff out of their nose every morning. Their white chickens were black. I interviewed a couple named Thurman and Thelma Buffalo Head, who described all of this. They were sick all the time. And they were desperate to get away from there, but the BIA had control, Bureau of Indian Affairs had control over whether they could get different land, and it was kind of unprecedented for somebody to get other allotment land. I recovered memos where the BIA said, this land cannot be sold because it's too contaminated to be sold. But the people kept protesting. BIA finally said, okay, we'll get you some different land. And BIA turned around and sold the land to HUD, which then proceeded to build low-income Indian housing right under the stacks of the carbon black plant. And they moved 20 Indian families with little children into this area that was so polluted the land could not be sold to anybody else. And when I started digging into this story, realizing, and cut me off if I need to, but...
I just wanted to point out that you got all this from just one conversation with somebody else, right?
One conversation. She told me a little about the story, and then I started... She said, you need to go look at this housing. These kids cannot even go out to play. They're not even allowed outside. They all have asthma. And when I went to look, I found it was the case. And also found out that the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality was not doing anything to stop that pollution.
And it's also interesting because I know you mentioned to me over the phone that you get a lot of ideas from the business sections of local newspapers. Can you talk briefly about that as
well? I do, and I got one recently. I had not really been aware that Oklahoma is one of the largest repositories for hazardous waste from all the rest of the country. And it's in a tiny community in Major County, Oklahoma. There's almost nothing else in Major County. And they are bringing in toxic waste, hazardous waste from everywhere else. And I hadn't seen anyone cover that. I just haven't seen it. But I saw a business section story in the Oklahoman about this facility in Major County and thought, that's a story.
Yeah. There's a lot of shady business going on with businesses, so it's a great source for information. What about the rest of you?
From a more nuts and bolts perspective of finding stories, if you look at, I don't know how many of you regularly look at academic research or federal studies, state studies, that's one good way that you can always follow into the modeling section and look at the demographics of a lot of those studies, whether it's looking at, air particulates or BPA exposure and some of the more insidious endocrine disruption. often you'll find that those are communities that are marginalized, you know, low income, minority communities. Two more quick ways. One, I mean, just as a good reporter, when you're reporting a story, the who is one of the W's that you're asking. That's why I don't think you need to go looking for environmental justice stories. If you're asking who in your reporting, you're going to, you know, ask who's being impacted. The other one, and to go back to the Flint example, what's going on in Michigan right now, there was community groups complaining about the water coming out of their pipes for a year and a half now. Now, they weren't complaining that it was lead. They were complaining about the smell and the taste. But where there's smoke, there's fire. And again, if a reporter would have kind of followed that, and there wasn't a study for them to directly tie into the lead, but there was a knowledge gap, there was a data gap, the state wasn't doing its job.
It's also just really, so one of the stories that I wrote last year was about, actually came out of an SEJ conference, and it was about the rise of, not citizen science, but they called it civic science. So with the rise of very cheap technology, Arduinos, Raspberry Pis, just like very cheap microprocessors and controllers, a lot more grassroots organizations are able to do the kinds of environmental monitoring that you used to have to turn to either a very big environmental organization for, and it used to cost a lot of money. So for example, this one group out of Japan, sort of, was able to create a Geiger counter that cost $500 as opposed to a $10,000 Geiger counter. And they were able to prove that after Fukushima, the radiation maps were wrong and they were evacuating the wrong people. And the government denied it. And they were also able to prove that the government had known this for a while, but didn't want to be shamed. So they wanted to save face. So one of the things is that there are actually a lot of cheap technology. So if somebody comes up to you and says, I think there might be a problem, there's very cheap ways for you to sort of investigate if maybe there's something worth investigating more. And bringing in sort of the bigger guns, and then there are plenty of environmental groups like Waterkeeper Alliance, that's what they do is grassroots monitoring, and that a lot of that data may exist in some capacity. But if it doesn't, there really are a lot of really cheap ways of finding out that information, to tell if this is something where you should go even harder. That's all.
That's all really awesome stuff that you said, and I agree with. I mean, the regular source work is always important because there's always a big, tight-knit community that is has been dealing with these issues for a long time, and usually just talking to people and maintaining relationships is good. But I go to the data a lot as a starting point for stories. ECHO, TRI from EPA, your state air permitting and inspection databases, even though, I mean, they're not really comprehensive because part of the problem, I think, with environmental justice is that these communities aren't inspected and enforced as much as they should be, but it's still a good starting place. And one cool trick that I maybe would mention is if you do go on your state environmental department's database, Groundwater Bureau, Air Quality, whatever, and look for issues that have been unresolved and standing there for a long time, and then send a records request for emails about that issue, because there's very high likelihood that there's some good people in your environment department that are really frustrated about the pace of this thing. There's probably a good story there. And those are good sources to tap into. And usually through that records request, you can find some, disgruntled environment department employees that can give you some perspectives that wouldn't necessarily get otherwise.
Those are all really great suggestions. So, I would be curious to hear from all of you how long it takes for you all to report on your environmental justice stories and how much reporting goes into them, because I know sometimes it can be more, it can require a lot more research than an ordinary story. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
I guess I'll go because I'm holding the mic. They're definitely not the quickest stories to turn around, because a lot of times there are, site assessments, health assessments, environmental reports that just can't be read quickly. The data work is heavy and takes some manipulation. And also I find, especially in New Mexico, the understanding the historical and the cultural context of a given issue of pollution is really important, and also can't really be done very quickly, unless maybe you've been there for a long time reporting on the issue. So, let's see, the most recent environmental justice story I did probably took 2 months or so because of the amount of information I had to sift through and the amount of experts I had to kind of contextualize things with. And that's about a solvent plume in Albuquerque. But then I think sometimes just a slice of life kind of, you know, day in the life kind of story from an environmental justice community can be just as powerful as an investigative report because it can illustrate, you know, what actually life is like in these areas. And those don't usually take as long to turn out. So like a abandoned uranium mine story I did maybe just took a week. And I think it was actually just as good as some of the more in-depth stuff that I've done. So
I don't currently, although I guess I'm working on my first sort of long form investigative environmental justice piece. Most of my piece, one of the things that I found is oftentimes the data is already there. It's just that nobody gives a shit. I mean, sorry, not to be blunt, but it's kind of true. So like one of the stories that I did was also, it was based on a throwaway sentence. Someone was talking, everyone knows Louisiana's lost its boot, right? Southern Louisiana Louisiana no longer looks like a boot if you actually were to map it correctly. And somebody made a really throwaway comment that was like, as you know, as Southern Louisiana disappears, we're losing Cajuns. Because as it floods, the Cajuns are moving north because they no longer have livelihoods in the South. And once they get off the bayou, they're no longer Cajuns. And I was like, that is a beautiful and sad thing that nobody is talking about. We're fundamentally completely destroying these people's way of life. And so it's really not that hard to find a bunch of Cajuns. And so I did. And so in that case, the data was already there. And we already kind of knew that Louisiana was disappearing. But this was a different angle on sort of the traditional, like, we're destroying the environment story. And it was, and I got so many thank yous from Cajuns being like, thank you for writing this, way more than I ever thought read in these times, honestly.
Yeah, I would say the opposite. That's true in some cases. I've had quite a few stories where the data is not there. And when communities are saying, we have a cancer cluster, we have this coal plant, you know, what the hell is going on? And the answer is, you know, very few epidemiological studies are causal, if any. You're not going to dose people with chemicals. Time-wise, I don't know, you know, a month or two a day, you know, it depends on the story. But I think it's really important. It's very important where I work because it's what we do. But I think for anybody, it's really important to dig into the human health science, whether it's human studies, animal studies, because you may have people screaming on a street corner. And so far but they're not always right. You know, cancer and even, you know, behavioral problems are not directly from lead or, you know, these things, there are a lot of factors. So I think really engaging the science and talking to, you know, human health specialists and toxicologists is what's taken the most time for me.
My stories vary, you know, greatly. I, you know, I did one in New Mexico after the fire that swept through Los Alamos National Laboratory. And there was great concern in the pueblos surrounding, you know, downstream from Los Alamos, including Cochiti Pueblo, about radionuclides washing into the Rio Grande and into their pueblos. That one I turned around in a day. That was possible because I already knew people in the pueblos. I'd interviewed them for other stories before, so it was pretty easy to contact folks that I already knew and get interviews quickly. It was, you know, because so much press was there and they were making accommodations for reporters, it was not that hard for me to get onto Los Alamos grounds under that circumstance. But I've also had stories that have taken months and months and months. The carbon black story, I was living in New Mexico at the time, and so I was driving back and forth between New Mexico, between Santa Fe and Oklahoma, and, you know, White Eagle, Oklahoma. And it took a while to develop trust with people. I had been introduced to some Ponca people, and they introduced me to others, but to interview the older traditional Poncas, the Buffalo Heads, Thurman and Thelma. I first went to meet them with one of their relatives, and then didn't take out the recorder, didn't, you know, ask them if I could come back to do an interview, and they said yes. So I went back, and sometimes it takes that, because sometimes people in communities have been burned by the press. Sometimes, you know, they just don't trust outsiders. And developing that trust is essential. And that's why one of the reasons I became a freelancer, so I could have the flexibility to do that and to be able to cover stories like I felt I wanted to cover them. And the other issue was, you know, getting the scientists to talk about, you know, finding the appropriate people to talk about the health effects, getting documents out of the state of Oklahoma, getting documents out of the BIA, getting, you know, everything compiled together. But, you know, ultimately, it's worth it.
Good. So one more question before we open the floor for your questions. What are some cautionary tales that you guys have, or mistakes that you made early in environmental justice reporting, or that you're making now or recently? What are some things that you would caution people against?
I've never made a mistake.
I can go, yeah, sure. I think I mentioned the social, the historical, the cultural context part of this environmental justice reporting, which is sometimes the most important, I think, aspect of a story. And it's very easy, I've made this mistake, to miss really the point. For example, there's a big development going on outside of Albuquerque that to me seemed like an economic story, but really it was a story about the water rights of this old Hispanic farming community that was, you know, that were threatened by this development. It's easy, especially dealing with Native American communities that have a completely different view of nature and of what the significance of messing up the environment is. It's easy to misunderstand that if you're coming from a different culture, and it's also easy to make a caricature of the victims of environmental justice, which I think is very counterproductive. So that would be my cautionary tale based on my own experience. I don't know if you guys have.
Yeah, not to keep beating the same drum, but I think what I see sometimes, and maybe I'm guilty of it too, is it's easy to side with the mother who's talking about a contaminated child, or farmers dealing with pesticides and just painting, you know, Monsanto or something as an evil demon, which very well could be true, but that doesn't mean that Monsanto gave the child cancer. And again, I think that's where it's very important to try to make those scientific links and not just blindly. Aside with the person who your heart goes out to.
Great. Well, we're going to open the floor to questions from you guys. If you have any questions, just raise your hand and we'll get you a mic.
I guess I would push back on that a little bit as someone with a background in science and who loves to have the science there to support my journalism when I can. But like, I'm reporting a lot these days on legacy nuclear waste in the St. Louis area. And kind of like the example you gave, there's a lot of people saying, oh, I have cancer, my kid has cancer because of this waste. And there's actually a study that's just starting now where county health department's going to try to look at that, but as you say, it's really hard to do, and it's definitely hard to prove causality, and yet you have all these people with this issue, and I feel like not reporting on it isn't the answer either. Like, even if I can't say definitively, yes, this nuclear waste is causing these people's cancer, there's a lot of people who have banded together, created this giant Facebook group, et cetera, because they're afraid, and to me, that's a story, and the waste shouldn't be there. Like, you know, that's kind of the bottom line, is it shouldn't be there, whether it's caused their specific cancer or not. I mean, I think you still have to tell that story.
Yeah, the fear is still real. I mean, right? And it's, and yeah, if I, yeah, I totally agree with you. I don't have anything to add. Sure.
I find a lot of times there is a bunch of, there's a lot of concern when there's not a lot of data, and it seems like it's logical enough that there'd be a causal link. But I agree that that's not always the point, especially with Native American communities, at least in New Mexico, where there is definitely a cultural impact at play. There's ceremonies that can't be held in the river anymore because it's too polluted. There's a fear of the vegetables that are being grown culturally that they can't hunt anymore because of, you know, the radioactive runoff that the animals are drinking. So I think that is a very important part of the story, if not the story itself, when there's not any data, because we always want the data, right? We always want to be able to say that, yeah, A plus B equals C in this case. But, you know, I think writing about those cultural impacts is very much, you know, important part of the story. Sorry.
There's one other thing is we're talking about the whole point of environmental justice is we're talking about communities that are disenfranchised. And so oftentimes science doesn't go to those communities and doesn't do those studies and doesn't look at what happens when you site 4 coal power plants and a freight train and, I don't know, a nuclear power plant in the same community. Like, they are the test case, and that's kind of the problem where we don't know. Like, I was way up in Alaska, and it's known that for some reason they do have a tendency towards cancer, but nobody really knows why, because it takes 24 hours from New York City to get there. And so you're not going to get a lot of, and that's like when the weather is good. So you're not going to get a lot of researchers going up there to prove if the cancer cluster is true or not. But you talk to enough people, and everyone sort of has lost a parent relatively young to cancer in a village of like 800 people. It's kind of weird. So that's the other thing. That's the problem with the data is that like you don't have data if nobody's looking, and people are trying not to look at these communities. That's why we're putting these things in those communities, which I agree with you. I'm not saying we should run willy-nilly and just be like, everyone's right or whatever. But like in some cases, the role of the reporter is to get people looking.
Absolutely. Like, part of the reason the county is doing this study now is because there was so much media attention.
Does anyone else have any questions? Has any of you done environmental justice reporting and come up against any challenges?
The bat. I wanted to raise the issue of covering environmental justice internationally. And I've done some of that. It's much more difficult. I did a story in Indonesia some years ago, a place called Irian Jaya. It's West Papua New Guinea. And the people, the indigenous people there, at the time I did the story, were essentially being subjected to the same destructive genocidal forces that American Indians in this country faced 200 years ago. And the extractive industries, including Freeport McMahon Copper, which is an American company, were engaging in incredibly destructive mining practices and destroying the environment and the livelihoods of people who lived in Irian Jaya. It took 4 months to get a visa from the Indonesian government to even go there. And I went as a producer of cultural programs, so which was essentially true. Went into an area called Bintuni Bay, where a factory ship was taking the one source of nutritious carbohydrate, a sago palm tree, cutting them all down and turning it into plywood glue aboard ship. It was taking the major food source for an entire people. And that it was so hard to get in there. And when we ran the story on All Things Considered, it got some attention, but nobody has been back there since. And that is what I wanted to really, you know, I would love to encourage people to look at stories in other places, environmental justice stories, and to pay some attention to them, because in addition to the environmental genocide that was taking place when I was there, there is actual genocide taking place right now. People are being lined up and shot and pushed into ditches and buried in mass graves. And it is all because of a struggle over this extremely resource-rich province. And if journalists aren't looking, if international journalists aren't looking, it's going to continue.
Kendra, you'd brought up about how, you know, there's often not a lot of studies being done because nobody wants to look and they kind of want to keep things hidden. How do you guys go about getting quotes from government agencies or different places when you're talking about an issue that maybe they don't really want to talk about?
I think it depends on the agency. I feel like Ed might have more government experience than I do.
Yeah, well, it's hard. I mean, writing environmental justice stories is the only time that I've had a state PIO threaten to punch me in the face. And I think she was kidding, but I think she was also not kidding. But, you know, in the state governments, they usually will comply with a records request. You know, they'll talk, even though it's like a bullet point list of basically a staged interview. With the tribal governments, I do run into some trouble. One case writing about Isleta Pueblo, the tribe I mentioned with that, you know, can no longer hold their ceremonies in the water. We were doing a report on Clean Water Act violations in the Rio Grande that all flow into the tribe's land. And this tribe has a long history of fighting for clean water rights. They won a huge court case, were able to set their own laws, basically. But now those laws, nobody's just complying with them. They're all being broken. I could not, phone call after phone call, email after email, I just could not get an audience with the tribal council. So I actually printed out a stack of the violations and toxic releases that I was talking about, put them in a folder and went down to the tribal chambers and just grabbed the secretary as she was leaving the tribal council meeting and, showed her the documents and that was able to open up a line of communication. I don't think that's really I don't know if that's useful advice because it's not really like a standard trick you can use. But I do find that once you make that initial contact and you're transparent about your objectives, usually those lines of communication stay open in the government.
I covered a rural Michigan community that has legacy contamination from an old chemical plant, and I couldn't get the EPA to talk. After a first story, in that case, I published the story, and once it starts making waves and making the rounds and the community sees it, then they often pay attention and spoke to me the next time and provided what I asked for. So that was the method there.
The difficulty that I run into, everyone will respond, but sometimes it takes a long time to get the information. And I think you're absolutely right. If you go ahead and run something and say, we're going to have to say in the story that we were unable to get the information we need from this agency, you know, the agencies don't like that.
Vicky and Kendra and anyone else who wants to weigh in, can you guys talk a little bit about getting sources for your stories, unique sources that may not be the types of people that reporters generally talk to, and how you gain their trust as you work on your story?
Well, I have a couple of advantages. I'm Black, which helps. I mean, I'm half joking, but I'm also not. Like, I just came back from Greenland, which is primarily Inupiaq. Like, they're the same, just came back 2 months ago, but they're the same population that sort of like northern Alaska, across Canada, they migrated east to Greenland. And one of the biggest benefits of being Black was I was immediately visibly not Danish, and the Danes are the ones who colonized Greenland. And so it was weird because they don't get a lot of non-Dane visitors. And so literally strangers would walk up to me in the streets and be like, I want to talk. And so that was actually really easy. I think I also have a weird personality and a very large network of friends, none of which are really transmittable. Like, I can't, like, so people do just, strangers talk to me a lot, and that's, sometimes I talk back. I'm also sort of annoying and persistent, and I don't really care if you don't want to talk to me. So if I find somebody interesting or I find a throwaway, I will just contact someone and be like, let's have a conversation. And oftentimes things will spiral out of that. I don't know. I mean, I just know a lot of weird people, and I hang out in a lot of weird corners of the world, which I think is actually really helpful and beneficial. Honestly, more than anything else, is just like hang out and talk to people who are not like you. And that's, I think, more than anything, how I get a lot of sources. And my parents are really weird too, so they help.
I was at a diverse journalist conference once, and they were talking about how at conferences, like, for example, like these, we'll stick together with the journalists and go to the pubs and places where all the rest of us are, but we won't go to the ones where the locals hang out because it's a little scary to us. But if you really want to get those stories, you have to get out there and talk to the people.
And move a lot. I've moved, like, I don't know, 23 times in 5 years or something insane. Yeah, so move a lot. And talk to weird people. That's my advice.
I agree with that. And I also think that if you're a reporter who is willing to listen, people get that. They know if you're willing to listen. And sometimes I was with one of my editors, and it just happened that day that two or three people came up to me and just started telling me things. And I mean, I didn't have a badge on that said, I'm a reporter, I'm a writer. And she said, why do people just stop and tell you things? And I said, I look like I want to listen to them. And when they start to tell me something, I do listen. I do hear them. And that, to me, is the most important thing in getting, you know, getting people to trust you. And also, I think reaching out to people who don't that often get reached out to by the media is really important. And if they know that, you know, you're not coming in as some kind of big shot, you know, I'm a big time reporter and, you know, but that you see them, that you see their situation and that you really want to understand their concerns and their feelings. I think people will open up and become sources for you.
I loved particularly Kendra's answer to that, but I guess I want to push back and maybe ask the two white men on the panel to answer that question, because I know I didn't report a lot on Ferguson myself, but I know my colleagues who were reporting on it did sometimes struggle, and we had at the time only one African-American reporter in our newsroom, and she would often come back with better information. People were more willing to talk to her than they were to talk to my white colleagues who were trying to, you know, approach people respectfully and ask the same questions, but she was just more successful because she looked like the people that she was reporting on. And so can you overcome that, you know, and how do you, and maybe since you report on Native Americans, you could start.
Well, I'll be quick, because I report in Detroit, which is 83% black, and I grew up in the city of Detroit proper, not my grandmother lived there, and I visited. I grew up in Detroit, and I've had more of a connection since I lived there, and I can go, I don't live there now, but I can go into people's homes and talk about the Polish deli that I used to go to or whatever. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I find common ground, just having a geographic connection and the fact that, I can connect to the neighborhood. I guess being a white male hasn't, you know, harmed me in that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very valid point. And I think that maybe we do get, have a little bit more of a shell to crack through, at first, because, you know, being a member of the kind of, in New Mexico, at least, maybe, I don't know if you want to call it the colonist like group, there's such a long history. And not only am I not Native American, I'm not Hispanic. I use Hispanic instead of Latino, because that's kind of the preferred term in New Mexico. So, it can be a challenge, but also people are very willing to hear you out and give you a chance. It's not like a barricade you can't get through. And I think really the key to unlocking the trust of the communities that I'm maybe coming from the outside of is to build a body of work that they can refer to, and I can build some trust that way just by showing that, hey, you know, these are the stories I've written. And word travels quick. Those are tight-knit communities in New Mexico. So, you know, the more work you do, the easier it becomes. But, you know, it might be easier if I was Native American, if I was Hispanic. I'm not sure.
I think the other thing, the thing about going into a community that you are not a part of or don't understand is to really make sure you don't go in with your assumptions or that you're not reporting with your assumptions. I did a feature story in Atlanta for Good Magazine about the urban farming movement with the African-American community there, and it's a really cool movement that they are having down there. But my main source there, he was very willing to take me around, but there was always this distance, and he always felt guarded around me because he said, you know, like, his community is very distrustful of reporters and the way that reporters might portray them and that kind of thing. But I sat down with, I think, three women who were part of his program, and they were talking about their experience. And I kept asking them, I mean, I think they were saying something about how farming, you know, for them had often been linked to slavery because of their history with it. And that's what they, that's the only thing that you really see in textbooks, like just black people farming as slaves, even though they've had a long history of doing farming in other contexts. And so they kept talking about history, and they kept talking about how important it was. And although I kind of understood what they were saying, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't putting words in their mouth and I wasn't making assumptions. So I sat there, I think, for 3 hours just asking them. And at first they were very guarded, like, why are you questioning what I'm saying? And when I explained, well, it's because I don't want to put words in your mouth, like, they were really grateful at the end that I spent the time to ask them and that I didn't make assumptions. So I think that's really important.
Hi, I'm Tina Cassegrand. I'm an independent journalist in Missouri. And I was wondering if you have ever had experience with kind of the reverse problem of what Brian was talking about, where you can bring people data saying, hey, there's an environmental issue in your community, and they're somewhat in denial about that being the case. I know of a few instances in my state where, because of various political and also just very personal values that people have, they don't want to admit that they've endangered their family or that there's a problem. Yeah, or their livelihood is dependent on it. So have any of you run into that issue? And how do you deal, how do you give weight to what they're saying and just, yeah.
Absolutely. I just finished a story about a chemical plume that's moving through an industrial area in Albuquerque. The residents are usually open to at least hearing, wait, let's see what you're talking about. But the businesses, their financial interests are at stake. Like, if I'm going to come and say, hey, look at this that I found, your property value might be, you know, might be a problem. This might become a Superfund site. That is not something they want to hear. And what I usually found is, you know, kind of ambivalence, like, well, I need more information. It hasn't been studied enough. And I mean, well, yeah, that's the point of this story. You know what I mean? But I don't know how to get around that. I mean, you know, you talk to enough people and usually somebody will, you know, be open to being on the air about it. But there's definitely, I mean, we have like food manufacturers, breweries, all these things that like are manufacturing products, and their whole business model depends on people trusting that it's safe and wanting to come in and spend time there if it's like a tap house or something like that. So I think there's a lot of fear in that regard, especially in the business areas.
Extreme example of that is the Tar Creek Superfund site in northeastern Oklahoma, where from mining waste there are these enormous mountain size piles of lead-laced chat, lead dust everywhere blowing across towns. The town is now gone, but that was mostly because of subsidence and, you know, because of the mining underneath. Homes were collapsing underground, so people had to leave. But when I started working on that story, there were so many people in that area living under this blowing lead, and they did not want to acknowledge that it was an environmental disaster and that there was no cleaning it up. It could not. It's uninhabitable. And they wanted to keep their town going. There were businesses there. They wanted to keep their businesses that had been in their families for generations. They didn't want people to be afraid to be there. And yet, it was some of the worst cases of denial I've ever seen. However, they were still willing to talk. And they were still willing to give interviews, and that's valuable. It's valuable to show how people react in the face of that kind of contamination.
This isn't a story. I'm working on a kind of a long, very long form story that's looking sort of at this issue at towns that have been destroyed and sort of are very stubborn. It seems very American tendency to be like unwilling to accept reality. And so I think the question is like, so it's not just Turk Creek, like you guys have heard of Centralia, right? Like the coal fire in Pennsylvania. There are still people who live there. The USPS like said you don't exist in like 2000, but there are some people who are still really stubborn. There's a town in Ohio that bought out all of the residents because it was so polluted, but there are still people who refuse to be bought out and they're still living there. And so I think the issue is not people unwilling to accept the reality of the situation. It's a question of choice, right? So if people know that they're being poisoned or they're living in a place where they should not be living, having the option of like the polluter buying them out and moving them to a much better location is the ultimate goal. Now, if somebody chooses to stay and deny all they want, that's on them, right? But like really what we're trying to do is give people, empower people with choice.
Because that, like, I think that is an intractable problem on native land. Sometimes the issue of abandoned uranium mines in the Navajo Reservation is really nefarious, because there's this irony that there's these problems that haven't been cleaned up, but there's a cultural belief that you can't leave your homeland. Like your umbilical cord is buried here. Spiritually, you're tied to the land. So there's communities that know that they're probably going to die from this uranium poisoning, but that, you know, their cultural beliefs are stronger than that, and so they're just they're staying there even though. So moving out of the area is just not always an option.
Great. Are there any other questions? If not, I've got tons. Ed, so I had mentioned that KUNM does a lot of multimedia alongside your stories. Can you talk a little bit about the process of, because I know you had some great data visualizations and all these things looking at the data. So can you talk a little bit about how, I guess, the project comes together and how your reporting goes into that?
Yeah, one of the cool perks about environmental justice reporting is that when there is data, which a lot of times there is, at least in some level, it makes for really great multimedia opportunities. So a lot of times, like I was saying earlier, I start by looking at the inspection reports or the enforcement reports and things like that. And usually there's a trove of information available online that you just can't include in a radio report. And like they say, you know, the quickest way to get someone to change the channel is to start talking about numbers, but that's not true online. And if you have some multimedia skills in terms of mapping, data visualizations, you can really expand on your reporting in a way that's just not possible on the air. So whether for us that's making a timeline of Clean Water Act violations to go along with a story about, you know, native impacts of surface water pollution, that'll show not only is it fun to play around with and embarrassing for a lot of polluters, but it illustrates the historical aspect, I think, really well, and kind of the continuity of environmental problems. Overlaying air permits, air pollution permits with asthma rates is really interesting. There's all kinds of ways to do it. And luckily, we've hired a data reporter to handle that kind of stuff, so it doesn't take as much of my time as it used to.
I know that a lot of you have received awards and recognition for your work. Have you had any tangible effects of some of your reporting, maybe things that got changed or policy that's been changed? et cetera?
The Carbon Black story that I was talking about earlier was a story that hadn't gotten any attention, and putting it on radio, Living on Earth gave me 17 minutes for that story, which was fantastic. And it was, there was so much to it, you know, with the Department of Environmental Quality acknowledging that all of these hundreds of complaints, they kept reporting back that there was, it was not carbon black that people were finding all over their window sills and turning the white-faced sheep completely black, you know, miles downwind, and showing up in their lawn, I mean, walking across their lawns. And this happened to me when I went to do interviews, getting coated up to your knees with this stuff. Department of Environmental Quality insisting for years and years that it was not carbon black, and then getting them to admit that the test that they used to determine whether or not it was carbon black was incapable of making that distinction, admitting that their test was faulty, and having a policy that in order to give the plant a citation for polluting, their own inspector would have to actually witness the pollution crossing the fence line and going off the plant site. And since the plant released all of the carbon black during the nighttime when it's dark, that was had always been impossible. So I was really grateful to SEJ for the radio award that this one, when I did the story. Other reporters started looking more, local reporters in Oklahoma started looking more at the story, started holding DEQ's feet to the fire, and there were some lawsuits filed. I won't go into all those details because it gets pretty complicated, but eventually, just this June, there was a lawsuit filed by the Department of Justice and the state of Oklahoma was settled for $158 million. And finally, the plant, they'll have 6 years to do it, but they must install state-of-the-art pollution control equipment and stop those releases, or they have to go out of business. And so finally, after all of this time, I mean, it's taken a long time, but I do feel that bringing the story to national attention really helped. In, because in Oklahoma, I mean, the way the politics are here, it's all about protecting your businesses and less about protecting the folks who suffer the consequences of businesses that are badly run. I
so think, the question was, what was the gap between when your story ran and this year? Right.
I did the story in... sometimes I can't remember what decade something happened in. I've been doing this a long time. I think it was 2005 or 2006. So it's been about 10 years, and you know it'll be 2021 before they have to ultimately clean up. So
how did you get them to admit that the test wasn't actually actually able to tell whether it was carbon black?
I interviewed everybody I could find who knew about this kind of test, and interviewed some scientists who talked about who knew about fine particulates and what happens when they go into the atmosphere. So, and one of them was one of the scientists who studied a lot of fine particulates along the highways in Los Angeles and other places like that, and has done some amazing work. But he said that, I got the documents from DEQ about exactly what their test was, and then I took that to these other scientists. They were looking at the samples that they took out of people's homes and off the sheep under the microscope. and they say, well, carbon black is an ultrafine particulate, and these are larger clumps, and therefore they can't be carbon black. But these other scientists said, no, once this hits the atmosphere, you know, there are all of these influences upon them, and they start to clump together, especially after they land on something. And then when you take the sample, you're also helping them clump together more, so under the microscope, you don't see them as ultrafine particulates. So that's, I mean, they didn't, in the face of that, they, well, I don't know. They, I mean, I was recording and, you know, I presented this and they said, well, yes, you're right. I think I was lucky because a lot of agency people would just keep beating around the bush and never be straightforward about it.
Great. Well, I guess we'll close with, if any of you guys have, well, we wanted to give you some ideas to run with for environmental justice stories. So if you, any of you guys have any ideas or have any, have heard of any environmental justice stories that you've been wanting to cover but haven't had a chance to cover that you would like to share that maybe people in the audience could look into some more?
Yeah, I think there's two things I was thinking about for this panel where I think is maybe a little undercovered. One is, we were talking about lead, and that's an example of something we found was bad and got out of homes. And the people that deal with it now are people that don't move into new homes or can't afford. And I think when you look at things like BPA and phthalates and flame retardants and a lot of these endocrine disrupting chemicals that we're now realizing have some impacts, as we start to phase these out of products, the people who are less likely to adopt new products, the people who are less likely to afford a new couch, a new TV, a Nalgene bottle that's BPA free, are obvious, you know, there's going to be an income link there. That's one thing. And real quickly, the other one, and you're starting to see more of this coverage is, and Veronica was talking about this, the idea of cultural erosion, and maybe not actual health impacts, but things like climate change, melting glaciers that are maybe sacred to Buddhists, or, you know, rivers drying up to Native American communities, that are, so the idea of maybe not actual health impacts, but a cultural impact on traditions and things of that nature.
Sounds weird, but it's awesome. Zoning. This is an issue that fascinates me because so often there was a lot of environmental justice stories can be traced back to a county commission meeting or a city council meeting where the government actually codified a situation of environmental racism by inviting heavy industry in to a poor neighborhood. And it wasn't always that long ago. Like in Albuquerque, I think it was the mid or late 70s that they rezoned this old Hispanic farming community as M2, which is heavy industrial, things like explosive plants and, I mean, you name it. And now the neighborhoods are still there, some, you know, for some part, but they're surrounded by chemical factories or gas refineries, and the agricultural way of life is long gone. But the asthma rates and diseases and all kinds of chronic health problems are there like they weren't before. So I think it's really fascinating to go back and find what was going on at that point in time and explore that a little bit and draw it out to today, because I was surprised at how recently these decisions were made and how impactful they were and are, continue to be, to these communities that are living with them.
I would love to see more reporters concentrating on international environmental justice stories. Guatemala, years ago, I was working on a climate change story, and an electrical utility was having trees planted in Guatemala to offset their carbon emissions. And it was this big feel-good story. But I realized that when I was there, people were farming these extremely steep hillsides because that was the only land they had access to. The multinational corporations and the ultra wealthy had control of all of the flat land, and so indigenous people primarily were farming on hillsides that shouldn't be farmed. And now we had these recent mudslides, which was a horrible disaster. And it's, you know, a lot of times we don't really look at enough at what's going on in countries around us, but we're all connected, and I would just encourage more reporters to take on some of those stories.
I'm going to follow up with Ed's zoning question with one equally as unsexy, and it's supply chain management, because so many of these problems are traced back to what we're like obsessed with. So like we know, like everyone knows like what happened with quinoa when it became super popular. So like we end up with these like weird fads in this country, and it usually is screwing something up someplace else. And so like anytime something is new or interesting or innovative, just asking like where did it come from, is usually a good link to like finding weird stories.
Okay, so I think my idea builds off both of those. Mining, gold and silver mining in Mexico and elsewhere are huge, huge problems. Most of the company, and it's mostly because of NAFTA, which opened up a lot of indigenous land to multinational corporations from U.S. and Canada. These companies, mostly from Vancouver, are going into these Mexican indigenous communities like in southern Mexico and Oaxaca and elsewhere, and basically acquiring native land, and there are no environmental controls. The consequences are absolutely devastating, and the violence and heartbreak that it causes, I can't stress enough how much more attention it needs. There is no Kimberley process for gold or for silver. There is no fair trade, you know, standard. I think maybe that's changing. I know there's a jeweler in Santa Fe that just got a fair trade designation, but there's no way to trace it. It goes to China, to all this, you know, other secondary markets, and then it gets back to, you know, Kay's jeweler or whatever, with a diamond that's certified conflict free, that's housed in the bloodiest gold you can imagine. I mean, I've had several of my sources murdered by paramilitary groups that the mining companies hire. It goes on and on. They're fascinating and very heartbreaking stories, and I really wish more people would pay attention to those.
And the Kimberley process doesn't work, so
yeah,
there's that.
I knew someone was going to say that, but at least yeah. It is a process. There's nothing comparable for gold.
Just had to say that.
Okay.
Also, even giving a shout out to Dave back there, who took me to a gold mine in April. He's with IJNR, and in the U.S., in Nevada, and it was perhaps the most horrific thing I've ever seen, and that's with environmental regulations in place. I kind of am in fear of what's going on in Mexico, and nobody yet. 85% of the gold that's generated goes to, like, jewelry and rich people. 15% of it's usable, so it's perhaps the worst thing ever invented, or mined.
Great. So with that, go forth and do some more environmental justice stories. And if we could give a big round of applause to our wonderful panelists, they did a great job.